Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
Hey, speaking of insane, there's Albert. Albert, I called you Albert.
Albert Berger.
My co-host, Albert.
Gandalf the Great is with us today.
I should get a pipe, right? And a staff, I think. I am happy to be back. Never missed an episode. I'm sure there's plenty of listeners in the same way. And as I've mentioned before, and Tom's teased me about, I keep talking to you guys, even if you're long gone from the show. It was pre-recorded, and I'm putting in my 2 cents worth and thanking each of you for your contributions. So you were talking about something for this show, and I just happened to be reading Gabor Mate's latest book. It's called The Myth of Normal, Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture. And he's talking specifically about the two traps with trauma, and one is ignoring it, which doesn't resolve the problem, and the second is getting stuck in it, getting in a repetitive loop of needing vindication, of blaming, and so on and so forth. And the only way out is understanding, and it's a great opportunity for understanding. And most people thrive from trauma because they with help get through. But here's the paragraph that really sort of touched me. Seeing trauma as an internal dynamic grants us much needed agency. If we treat trauma as an exterior and an external event, something that happened to or around us, then it becomes a piece of history we can never dislodge from. If, on the other hand, trauma is what took place inside us as a result of what happened, in the sense of wounding or disconnection, then healing and reconnection becomes tangible possibilities. Trying to keep awareness of trauma at bay hobbles our capacity to know ourselves. Conversely, fashioning from it a rock-hard identity, whether the attitude is defiance, cynicism, or self-pity, is to miss both the point and the opportunity of healing, since by definition, trauma represents a distortion and limitation of who we were born to be. Facing it directly without either denial or over-identification becomes a doorway to health and balance. And in that way, I see emotional sobriety as finding our balance, right? Being, neither for nor against if we're overly excited about an issue. And also just not blaming myself, not blaming others, but wanting to understand that other people just like me are going to act in direct response to their programming and conditioning. It isn't personal, as it was once wisely written in Emotional Sobriety by Alan Berger. And we can't take it personal, right? People are interacting as a result of who they are, not who we are. And I have a tendency to go, why is he looking at me that way? Why did he say that, right? And ruminating about it. That's not emotional sobriety. We should have a This Is What You Should Not Do episode. I got plenty of examples that are personal. Anyway, nice to see all you guys.
Read the first part of that paragraph again, please.
Yep.
I'll be in charge. I'll tell you when to stop.
Seeing trauma as an internal dynamic grants us much needed agency. If we treat trauma as an external event, something that happened to or around us, then it becomes a piece of history we can never dislodge. If, on the other hand, trauma is what took place inside us as a result of what happened, in the sense of wounding and disconnection, then healing and reconnection becomes tangible possibilities.
The only thing you control is yourself, your mind, your interpretation, and your decision how to respond. With that distinction that Gabor makes there, it's like it changes everything. Two or three of the people I'm working with trauma just popped into my head immediately that I'm thinking, I haven't had a way to say that as beautiful as you just read it. So, I mean, it's like that is because it brings what has been in the other category, things you cannot change, literally into the category of things that we're responsible to change. I've got what I need for the next 3 or 4 weeks right now. So thank you very much for that. And I can't wait to read that book.
I knew you'd be excited about it, Tom, because you've been such an advocate and strong proponent of people being empowered and not, even though they may have been victimized, not becoming a victim from being victimized. And you know, you've been talking about that ever since I first met you. I mean, that's a big, big part of you know, your nutshell wisdom. You know, the danger of what he just said, because there is something I want to throw out there to people. See, he's not saying it's all in your mind. And we got to watch, right? You got to watch when, you know, because bad things happen to people. Terrible things happen. We do become victimized by things in life. There's no question about it. He's not saying that it's all in your head. The issue becomes one is that the meaning we give to our experience is where we have the most opportunity to create change. The experience is going to be what it was. And it's oftentimes, you know, when people are molested as children, when they're abused as children, you know, they don't have many options other than to respond to it in the way they did. And then that becomes a big issue the rest of their life. And what he is saying is you're not stuck with that history. You can get in there and work on that and start to deal with it so that, you know, the way we say it in emotional sobriety is you claim your experience rather than the experience claiming you. And that's is what he was saying. But let's talk about how, because it's a great idea. What does that mean? If that is the end point, if we all sit here and agree, man, wouldn't that be wonderful to be able to take something that is so, you know, disabling and painful and wounding and convert it into something that is not, you know, informing our life in such a negative way. And in fact, you know, can we unpack it in a way that not just heals it, but makes us a wiser person, that helps us become more of what we can be rather than staying with the experience? Because trauma is a big subtractor. That's the way I think about it. It steals a lot of stuff from your life.
I have a friend who is suffering at work, and he's kind of stuck, and he's really unhappy, and he's really angry. And I fell into that trap that I've fallen in with different like relationships in my life, where I was just trying to help him spitball ideas for how he cannot suffer anymore. And as soon as I got off the phone, I'm just like, I did it again. He just wanted me to be with him as he suffered, not to help him in my misguided way to problem solve, to extricate him from that. Interceding to kind of like help somebody to claim an experience rather than being claimed by it, but also being with somebody in their suffering.
You know, we live in a culture that there is some solace in just staying stuck, like what Joe was talking about in the book. It's just repeating, you know, and really identifying with their trauma. It's like making that part of their identity. It's like the confrontation is that, by the way, when we do this, you're going to be responsible for making some changes. And you're the only person who can do it. We can help, but you have to make changes. And you get to decide what they are, and you get to decide when you do what you do. But it puts the person in, which is exactly where we want to be, in the position of responsibility and the ability to respond.
You know, Bill Wilson didn't have the language of trauma, let alone capital T trauma and small t trauma and all that sort of thing. But he was talking about getting to a place where you can as the meditators talk about, you know, I am not my thoughts, I am not my feelings, I am not my sensations, right? But if I can observe them, it creates a learning opportunity.
Let's talk about what does it take to be able to convert trauma in the way that we're talking about, right? In a way that it becomes a part of your life, but doesn't control your life. And see, that I think is a good way to think about this, is that a lot of times our work in therapy, and you know, you've said this a lot, Tom, and I've said this a lot, like we don't get rid of these certain parts of us, we have a different relationship to them. And that's what we're talking about, is changing the relationship to our experience that we had. And what does it take to change a relationship? Well, you put your finger on one thing, Joe, is when you said, well, when you observe it and you see it, see what we're doing and how we're doing it, that awareness becomes a prerequisite to change. But it's not going to create change in itself. It opens a door to creating an experience that can help now that conversion process. So let's go back and talk about what kind of experience does somebody need that's facing trauma. Now think about this. I love the way that someone showed me this, is if we think about the word resolve, put a hyphen between re and solve. What we're doing, we're resolving. What does that mean to resolve it? Well, it means, first of all, to give the fine words and find the courage and support to say the things we dared not say in that situation. The things that we may have thought, but we were too frightened and scared to say. To find the part of us that wanted to object, you know, to being, you know, controlled, to being powerless, to being molested, to being abused, to speak back to an abuser, which we wouldn't have dared done it before because we would have gotten hit or we would have gotten beaten a lot worse. See, these are the things that when we talk about dealing with trauma, we're talking about going back and giving ourselves an opportunity to re-experience so we can resolve or finish the business that wasn't finished when the trauma occurred.
Just to, if I can use your example, Alan, of being a young boy and losing your father. I mean, you have no language to solve that, to reframe that. And it just don't, we're only at a certain maturity level. In this book, The Myth of Normal, Mate talks about, trauma is subverbal. In some cases, kids are so young, it's preverbal. They have no language at all. But for all of us, when we're dissociated or when we're enraged, my vocabulary is gone anyway, right? Like I can't articulate the situation where I am. But with the help of another or reviewing it myself or taking inventory, that is a great opportunity to resolve it. What else could this mean, what they said to me? What else could this mean? How could they do this to me? All of these things we can reframe.
You know, how dare you do this to me?
Yeah.
How you were wrong. See, it's so funny in therapy. We're so afraid to say to someone, that's wrong.
Yeah.
That is wrong, what you've just done. But a kid needs to call out the truth and not sit there and go into this psychobabble world and not, you know, label the experience as it is. You were wrong to do that to me. It's wrong for a parent to treat a child like that. It was wrong for you to beat me just because I didn't do what you wanted me to do. You were not a good parent. See, we got to own that sometimes. Be free of that. And in this culture, we're so afraid of saying that's wrong. Oh, my God. Like it's politically incorrect.
Well, and that's good, Alan, because I mean, that's one of the things so often somebody we're working with trauma is it's going to be another piece of support and recovery in and of itself, because they didn't have people to help them. They didn't have support. And to me, it's amazing. I have a client I work with trauma, and I ask her to do little bullet points after our sessions. Tell me what her takeaways from the sessions are, and it took that from Irv Yalom. You know, it's always amazing to me how different hers are than mine. She it's the simplest little thing sometimes, but that would be one of them. That would be you if I just normally said, oh, I'm so sorry that happened to you. That should never have happened to you. You know, and I think probably I said something which probably other therapists would jump on, but I said, I'd like to find that guy and take him into a back alley right now, you know? And it's like, she talks about like feeling supported in a way that she never could. She never told anybody because there was nobody who was going to even verbally support her. And that's a beginning.
So Joe, where has some of what Gabor Mate was talking about been showing up in your life and your emotional sobriety?
I feel duty bound often, right? Oh, I have to do this. I have to do that. I wish I wasn't so busy. But I've got all this stuff that has to be done. And then I feel victimized by this things to do list that nobody has put on me. I've created it. Like I see, those are my thoughts. I say them like they're facts. Are they? That's a process I will do with myself and anyone else I'm working with. You know, you say that like it's a fact. Is it? What else might that mean? And I find over and over, I have these deadlines that have to be met that no one's put on me. And I feel I blame myself for not being ready. I feel I have no freedom because of all of these demands upon me. And it's just not true. And you know, part of emotional sobriety is that think slogan we have, right? You know, my first thought is, they say your best thinking got you here. No, my impulsive thinking. Right. My best thinking did get me to the AA meeting. Right. But my impulsive thinking was going to keep me in perpetual, destruction. So that happens in my day to day life today not in life and death circumstances as, you know, hiding my drinking and my drug use from other people, but certainly in these ideas I have about the world, what it demands of me, and, you know, this idea of abundance or deprivation, right? Like, they're all made up ideas I have that drive me. They're core beliefs, right? You know, which self-knowledge of them doesn't free me from, but I can at least separate myself. And I go, that's my inner critic talking, right? That's my, it's never going to, Tom's not here. It's unfortunate because he always says, you never need to beg for their ideas. They always volunteer them, right? These voices in my head. And that is a daily process for me, to answer your question.
Yeah, listen to what Ernie Larson says in his book, Destination Joy, right? Where Destination Joy is all about facing trauma in our recovery. And he even calls it stage three recovery, which, you know, it makes sense. I see it as part of emotional sobriety, right? Is that this is about dealing with, you know, whatever issues are coming up for us and finding a way to get past that. I'd be okay if this didn't happen to me. I mean, we talked about that as a version of, you know, I'd be okay if, right? I'd be okay if this didn't happen to me. And we, you know, that's, you know, a lot of us feel that it's understandable, but it flies in the face of reality. It did happen. What am I going to do with it? This is what he says. He says,
We are meant, this is Ernie Larson, right? He goes, we are meant to have genuine choices as adults. To realize those choices, we must learn to mentally and emotionally separate from that powerless, helpless child of the past. And he's talking about abuse in childhood, right? Because abuse doesn't, trauma doesn't just occur in childhood, right? If people go through a natural, like there's a lot of families that are adults traumatized by what happened in California. There's people being traumatized, but what's happening in our political system right now in terms of feeling.
All those people that climbed out of the airplane in Toronto.
What happened? I didn't know about that.
A Delta flight from Minneapolis to Toronto flipped over on landing. Everyone got out alive, but can you imagine, you know, being turned upside down and hanging from the roof?
I heard something happened. I didn't know what it was. Yeah, that would be traumatic.
I love Tom, the little rascal, just laughing. Just like, oh, that's fucked up.
See, I mean, my strange brain, the first thing before Joe even said upside down, I was like, well, that'll turn your world upside down. You know, I'm just constantly entertaining myself with inappropriate humor.
So he goes on to say here, let me just finish this. He says, we must learn to mentally and emotionally separate from the powerless, helpless child of the past. We must then learn to make decisions in the here and now based on who we choose to be as adults. Recovery beyond sobriety is learning to be an adult, not a terrified, angry child forever acting and reacting to yesterday in an adult body. That's the maturity we talk about, right? That's the transcending, right? The trauma and stuff into, you know, self-support in terms of becoming what we can be.
As Bob Subbe says in Lost in the Shuffle, as children were victims, as adults were volunteers. You know, means we have some choices, but it's like, the truth is lots and lots of people who've been severely traumatized, I see this a lot with sexual trauma, move into adulthood, and they no longer need their external perpetrators because they become their own perpetrator. They continue their trauma just almost through habit, and it's because they don't know anything different. They keep recreating it again and again and again. And it doesn't mean the other people who are involved are not responsible, not bad people doing bad things or something. But it's like what it means is, we have to be careful that when we've been traumatized severely. Clearly, as adults, we unconsciously volunteer for trauma, and we're the ones who have to become responsible to step in there, and you know, with help, somebody could have help now. We can help them, but they have to basically take the lead and protect themselves by making new decisions. Because the trauma's not always over by the time they reach us.
Yeah, I was going to ask Alan because. You know, I just found it so inspiring when you started to do some of your own trauma work. And I think it was within a few months of when I fell off the cliff. It was a very packed time of incidents for all of us. I can't wait to hear your answer, Alan. So when you started to, you know, embark on that journey years after the incident, were you finding that the emotional sobriety framework that you'd been studying and developing all those years, like it fit like a glove, right? You were able to kind of like expand that to accommodate, you know, your trauma and help to unpack what it meant and how to start healing, right?
I think you witnessed that. I think that you had a ringside seat in those battles and stuff, Patrick. I mean, I pretty much lived that and, you know, in public view, you know, all that time. And it was amazing the feedback I got. So many people were so appreciative of the vulnerability I brought to that because it really helped them, you know, open the door to being able to face some of the things that were hard to face. And like I said, I couldn't have done that without the support I got from you, Tom, Roger, Joe. I mean, I'm very blessed to have many good friends in my life. My sponsor, Tom, I mean, some great therapists have helped me work through my stuff and continue to, you know, the story's not, that chapter's not finally written yet. It's being written. And it's still unfolding in many, many, many challenging ways. But I think I am dealing with a lot of it from a much better foundation right now. I've gotten my legs back under me. For a while, man, I just got so knocked off balance. And that's what happens with this stuff. It brought back a lot of pain from unfinished business for me. You know, so yeah, you're right, Patrick. I think one of the things I experience is that as I integrate my experiences, my consciousness continues to expand. And I think that any good psychotherapy, any good experience in recovery, or any therapeutic experience in recovery is going to result in you expanding your consciousness. It's even stated that in step 11, right? You know, when we talk about, right, step 11, right, you know, about improving our conscious contact, right? And what that's about is continuing to expand our awareness of ourselves, of life, of our relationship with, or what if you have a relationship with a higher power, what that means in your life, and all of that stuff. And so the expansion of our consciousness is emotional sobriety.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that because one of the things that, I've been aware of for a long time is, and it goes with the stuff about we don't get rid of anything, we add to it. It's like in, like, you know, your way of doing it in your book is just add more self. You know, it's like get, you know, it's never substitute. It's never take things away. But you think about growth. Growth is always expansion. You know, think of a seed, anything growing, it's going to expand its knowledge. It's going to expand its awareness. It's going to, you know, it's like, we're not going to become, we don't go the other way. If we did, then people would come to us and we would, you know, try to put them in a trance and create a really nice little shell of denial for them that they could live in, you know, pain free. It's like, we don't do that.
Don't make it sound so nice.
it's really nice. It's like, what's it going to take for me to put you in this little shell of protection today?
Pill or the blue pill?
Yeah, that's right. But it's always more. And it's exciting.
It is exciting. It's really exciting. And, you know, to discover new possibilities is, and the curiosity to do that and the excitement of the search.
You talked about this in the last episode about maintaining curiosity. And I try to bring curiosity and positive regard to everything in life. It's an antidote to what we were talking about, right? It's an emotionally sober way to...
Why are we so old and doing this for so long and not burn out? It's like, it's because what we're talking about right now, because first of all, we're not going into the therapy room and doing the same thing over and over again, you know, and I'm not trying to diss other people, but there are therapists who are a lot more methodical who do that process. It's like they have a certain model and that person's needs just fit into that certain model. It's like, you know, what we've discovered is it's so much more fun to embrace the art of it as well as the science. And you go in fresh. And Carl Jung said that. He said, for every patient I've seen, I've invented a new therapy. And I love that idea. And he just wrote about he tries to basically drop everything he knows before he goes in to meet somebody for the first time. It's like, it's impossible literally to do it, but it's a beautiful mindset to do that because, you know, after you've seen as many clients as we've seen, after we've seen as many people as we've seen, including you, Joe, is the idea that we have a lot of assumptions we can make when people start talking. They're going to say a lot of things that are very familiar to us, and it doesn't necessarily mean they're like that other person that we talked to last week or last year. It's like we need to keep listening, stay curious, and we need to do that with ourselves as well. It's like, which I don't mean that as like doublespeak, but it's like one of the things I've been working with people on is just listening, practicing listening to their own intuition. You know, we have a wisdom inside of us that we do not take nearly enough advantage of. It's like what you said before, Joe, that the saboteurs are never unsolicited. You never have to ask their opinion, but the wisdom you do, it's just like wise people. If you want something from them, you got to go ask. And they don't yell. So when you're asking for wisdom, it's not going to yell the answer to you. But you know, these other guys are very loud. But if you have to ask the wisdom and you have to listen carefully. But I promise, anybody listening, I promise you, every one of us has that voice in us, and it will talk to you.
Often people who are right don't say anything.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
That's why I'm always talking.
All four of us fit that criteria.
I was reminded of you, Joe, yesterday. There's a very kind of revered member of my home group who was talking about the plain language big book. We brought up a couple times in the show so far. But all the people in the meeting, you know, as soon as the plain language big book is mentioned, they're just, you know, rubbish, you know, not having read it. Right. Just because they've decided that, you know, they've read it already and anything new, you know, is bound to be, they're discrediting it even before even finding out. And I think it's just important to keep an open mind. You know, it's a stand in for a lot of things, I think.
We could say they're driven by fear, or they found what works and they've stopped looking. Right. You know, I sometimes envy those people.
Yeah, but they're stopping other people when they put their judgment out there. They're stopping other people from doing that. And I think that's Alan, one of the tenets of emotional sobriety is really intervening on our judgmentalness. You know, we need to talk some of that about that specifically down the line. I'm saying that to you and also Patrick, because Patrick is younger and has a better memory than we do. I wrote about judging as a young therapist, judging Sigmund Freud, but I hadn't read Sigmund Freud, but I had all these images, and then for some reason I needed to go study that, and I studied some of it and realized I was entirely wrong. It really was the opposite of what I had thought and when I was judging, I'm always willing to share. You know, I'm just like those little saboteurs inside. You don't have to ask me. I'm going to tell you, everybody's entitled to my opinion. Hopefully, I have learned in those situations to keep quiet.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.